I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. You could think of Somerville, Massachusetts as Boston's Brooklyn, meaning roughly, it used to be the crowded, colorful, low-rent, ethnic undershirt of the shining city. And now, almost overnight, it's hip and hot, with its own version of the boomtime blues that have come to Brooklyn and Bay Area, California, also Austin, Texas, and maybe Detroit one day soon. It's the divisive dark side of capitalism that will hit whatever city wins the next Amazon headquarters. It's a question of how to fit spikes of luxury housing and creative class workers in among the great neighbors, young and old, who've kept the place so attractive and will never be able to afford to live there again. The Zillow real estate listings tell all. A worker's house with a postage stamp garden on Fremont Avenue, for example, sold for $65,000 in 1995, now valued at $750,000, 1,000% gain over two decades, and not untypical. And Somerville is ready to fight about it. Voters last fall elected a supermajority of progressives and skeptics to the Board of Aldermen, poised now for a vigorous rethink of development questions. The focus is on Union Square, where a big new transit station will center a cluster of labs and offices under a 23-story tower for high-end housing. On the ground, you can feel change coming. From the Korean market to the famous Union Square Donut Shop, home of the brown butter hazelnut crunch and maple bacon specialties, we got the tour this week with Laurie Goldman, who teaches urban policy at Tufts and lives in Union Square.
What this used to be was elegant furniture store. It catered to the city's working class households. This has been a working class city of around 80,000 people since the Civil War. That's why it's called Union Square. It was the place where people gathered before they were conscripted. And that furniture store had to move because rents were going up. And what has replaced the furniture store that furnished the working class Somerville is the offices of the master developer and this work bar, which is a workspace for the millennial workforce.
Bring your laptop.
You can work here in community, which is a lovely thing. It's a very different population from the clientele of elegant furniture.
You know, I make websites. I started a company 3 years ago. We were attracted to Somerville as sort of a way to stay in the city and not necessarily have to rent.
Did you buy a house?
Yeah, we bought a condo.
What's changed in your time?
Every year, it's like a slow creep of new businesses or new people moving in.
But what would a family house set you back to buy in Somerville today?
It's like $1 million for a full house, or at least close, which is just crazy. It's crazy, yeah.
Ganesh, a young family man from Nepal, spoke about the tough rental market.
I came here in Somerville 2015, August.
What's your rent?
I'm paying $2,000.
A month?
Yeah.
For what sort of space?
Two bedroom.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
What kind of building? What kind of...
It's an old house.
And what's your family situation? Who do you live with?
My wife, two kids.
Wow. Two bedrooms, two kids, one wife, one you, and $2,000 a month.
For now, it's very difficult to pay rent. We are managing. No saving money.
And then three members of the Union United Coalition spoke about their efforts to forge a community benefits agreement with US2, the Union Square developer. Mary White lives in her family home and has a job as a crossing guard.
I was born here on Beacon Street in Somerville. Actually, I was the only one that was born in the hospital. All my mother's other children were born at home. And went to St. Joseph's School, which is in Union Square. We're losing a lot. Everything just keeps going up, and there's no notice of this being done so that you can at least prepare. And I'm doing this on my own. No one's going to help you keep your home. You have to do the very best you can to keep your home.
Ben Echevarria, with Puerto Rican roots, advocates for new immigrants, notably from Central America, Brazil, and Haiti, drawn to Somerville not least because it's a sanctuary city.
I'm a renter, and you know, I think every year one of the big things I struggle with is, which is coming up soon, is are they going to raise my rent? My parents bought a house here back in the 70s, and we set roots. I was born here. When it was time for me to go to school, my sisters and I were the only, you know, in a public grade school, we were the only people of color. You know, there was a lot of discrimination, a lot of fighting. You know, later on, we started to see a huge influx of people of color and immigrants and other people. And in fact, in 87 or 85, there was a court order forcing housing to integrate housing for immigrants and refugees. The largest populations, the three largest populations have been pretty consistent. It's Latinos, Brazilians, and then Haitians in the city. The Green Line, which is what's driving a lot of this, is a decision was made for the Green Line to come. Studies are showing mass transit tends to gentrify communities. So, I mean, we always say it's a great idea. And the problem with that is for who? And gentrification occurs. And it seems like everyone's like, well, we can just soften the blow. But at the end of the day, the people who you claim that you want to serve are no longer here. Progress comes on the backs of poor and people of color.
Bill Cavallini is a taxi driver and an advocate for affordable housing.
I actually came here first in 1973. I came here to go to school at MIT. I feel rooted in this city, even though I wasn't born here. Planning in Somerville has almost never been done by the government or the private nonprofits to the extent that it needed to be done. And that's why it's a predominantly residential city with very little commercial tax base. And that's why there's this pressure to have 60% commercial square footage in the Union Square development, because they want to even that out a little bit, 60% commercial and 40% residential.
Because Bill loves Somerville's stellar music program, K-1 through high school, I asked him, how is a mayor to float benefits like that and say no to new investors?
He doesn't have to say no, you know. He just has to say yes, but. My two granddaughters are in that music program that is a wonderful program. Every kid in the Somerville school system gets an instrument. That's unprecedented. The only other place I know of that happens is Venezuela. Okay? They're in the city chorus. They love the fact that they're in that chorus with people from all over the world, kids of families from all over the world. And I want that to continue. But it doesn't mean that you have to accept commercial development with no buts attached to it.
The mayor of Somerville, Joseph Curtatone, joins us from Buffalo. His son is playing hockey in Niagara Falls this week. Welcome, Mr. Mayor. You're in your eighth two-term. You're into your eighth term as mayor. Generally styled a progressive. Still only 51.
Yes.
Your Somerville, we picture it as up against the gentrification test. What's the choice here? New money on one hand, and on the other, social stability for the Somerville that made you from day one. Is this a solvable problem?
I believe it is. And I first want to say thanks for having me on the show. I wish I was near and warmer. Believe it or not, warmer.
We'll meet you in the Union Square one day soon. Go ahead.
Absolutely. But yeah, it is solvable. And I want to say how much I appreciate the passion and commitment to the community from those who I listen to, Ben and Bill and others, and people committed to making the city better. Yeah, I absolutely believe it's solvable. You know, we are trying to do something that we like to do in some of the abnormal. How do you wrestle the drive for growth and investment in this viral market, which sort of adds nitroglycerin to the fire, and leverage that to do social good to improve your community? And yeah, it's solvable if we follow our community values that, you know, not just mine, but the community come from people like the people who just spoke in your program.
Let me ask you, I mean, speaking of those people, why should a woman at retirement age, Mary White, feel at risk for the rest of her days in her own family's house?
Because it's true. We are in a crisis. This is a tremendous challenge that Somerville and the greater Metro Boston region and city regions like it across the country are facing. In the intro to the program, you talked about how many people want to be part of Somerville. It's great. I always hope that
to many of us who grew up there, that people would actually think of Somerville as Somerville, not Somerville, want to be there. They want to be part of the great community we always knew it was. And we love the fact that we have this amount of investment and growth. We just don't want to push out our soul, people like Mary White. They should be able to age in place in the community that they grew up in or were raised in. People who have kids now, they should have a true opportunity, not authentic choice, to stay here. And it is a tremendous challenge. I think a challenge that is solvable and that Somerville will lead the way on, but it's going to be a regional solution towards it. But I absolutely do believe that Somerville will be led by our values.
Speak of, as you started to, of Somerville as a most curious, bold, abnormal place, especially in this political context. What's possible? I walking through Somerville, I'm reminded of Tip O'Neill. It was the core of his district and his political thinking. It has a Bernie Sanders spirit and tilt to it nowadays. What might be done in a bold city?
Well, I always say when people refer to Somerville and our success, the most innovative city, I just think we're very curious and that we have a passion for curiosity on doing what is impossible. You know, we fought for generations for the Green Line where, you know, we've got Assembly Square moving. We've elevated our school district to a high-performance school district, but we've never done anything while abandoning our values. We've always held our values close. So what is possible is the abnormal. We've talked about the community's broad ideas in terms of taking on the affordability challenge that no other city has really done, and certainly not in this Commonwealth, you know, whether it's creating a transfer cheese to a tax speculation.
Who's going to break the rule? Who's going to break the rule of investment? Investors first development.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Well, you got to change some rules here on the priority of investors over people, over Mary White.
But they're not, well, that is not the rule here, some of them. You know, our values don't take a backseat to any investor. I appreciate, respect, and agree with what Bill Cannellini said. You don't have to say no, you can say yes, but.
Stand by. Coming up, lots more of you, Mr. Mayor, and also falling expectations from the knowledge industries and the creative class, with the writer Richard Florida, who named those places and made them almost a cure-all. I was naive, he tells us now. This is Open Source. At a moment when the whole world's population is migrating towards cities, we're getting a local sense of what's to gain, what's to lose, and who gets what in the testing ground of Somerville, next to Boston and Cambridge. If all of Massachusetts were as densely settled as the city of Somerville, you could fit 200 million people into this small state of Massachusetts, half of the U.S. population. The test ahead for Somerville turns on new money and 21st century industries, a new transit extension, and a lot of new voices in the political chatter of Somerville. J.T. Scott, just elected to the Board of Aldermen, is one of the newbies. He was born in Tennessee, schooled in engineering at Duke, drawn to the Occupy movement and the Bernie Sanders campaign in Boston. In an old auto repair shop in Union Square, Somerville, JT has opened a CrossFit workout center where we caught the new tone of voice this week.
Mr. Light, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. J.T. Scott.
So when you look around this room, it's a remarkable assortment. We have people of every gender, some who have actively chosen their own genders, and I will say that all of them live within about 10 blocks of here.
Come on, Penelope. Swing! There you go!
I'm dying to know how you got elected Alderman, what made you want to run?
Well, besides the world being on fire right now, I mean,
that's a reason.
That's certainly a factor. And there's a lot that we can do better here in Somerville. Somerville's a spectacular city. It's a fabulous place to live.
You live here?
I do.
Since when?
I moved into the Boston area back about 18 years ago, but always wanted to be in Somerville because that's where my friends were, the artists, the performers, the radicals. Unfortunately, most of my friends who are performers and artists can't afford to live in Somerville anymore. If you've gotten to spend any time in the neighborhood, you'll see the trellises covered in grapevines from the Portuguese families that moved here five generations and more ago, the Italian families that moved in through the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Incredible.
But we're seeing those grapevines vanish. The opportunity for us here is to restore a middle-class renaissance. There's a lot of fear around the Green Line coming here, saying that the gentrification that inevitably it brings will displace the people who are here. And I take a different view. As a democratic socialist, I believe that a rising tide can, in fact, float all boats. The question is, can we keep people in the neighborhood in order to gain the benefits of the development, of the enrichment that will happen here? That means ensuring that the people who live here right now aren't forced out or displaced. And that's where a community land trust can be a really vital tool. Community land trusts are nonprofit organizations governed by the neighborhood that create and preserve housing affordability in perpetuity by partnering with other nonprofits or by private homeowners or tenants to purchase land underneath the housing. At the same time, it governs the resale of that property to make sure that when it's sold, it's not a speculative investment. It's sold as affordable housing for the next generations that are moving here into Somerville.
That was J.T. Scott, the alderman at CrossFit in Union Square. Steve Meacham joins us in conversation with Mayor Joe Curtatone. Steve's an organizer in the grassroots activist network for housing justice in Greater Boston, known as City Life, a.k.a. Vida Urbana. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Big picture, the emergency, in your view, and the underlying problem, here, elsewhere, everywhere.
I think it is almost everywhere. And to focus in on this question of displacement for a moment, this is not a technical problem to fix. This is a moral problem. And if we look at how many people are affected by it, we're talking about tens of thousands of people in the Boston area faced with what is really a form of violence, being torn out of their homes and their communities, having their communities disrupted. That affects, like I say, tens of thousands of working class people, but especially communities of color. There are solutions to it. We don't have to look far. You could stop that from happening tomorrow if you want to.
How?
Through
and
intervention.
Speak to the mayor. See if he'll do it.
You can stop it by intervening in the market, either through some form of just cause eviction or rent regulation, or through supporting grassroots resistance. But, I mean, we're talking about a crisis of major proportions. And, you know, the question of the subway line coming into Union Square is a good example. Residents of along the Fairmont line in Boston fought long and hard to get new stops on the Fairmont line as an issue of transit racism, to get communities of color access to a commuter rail that ran under their neighborhoods, but they couldn't get on it. And they did win four new stops, and now they're all being evicted as a result of their victory. So
Where? In what town?
In Boston. You know, in Dorchester, in Mattapan, in Hyde Park. The Fairmont line runs right through the middle of all those neighborhoods, and everybody's reporting that the rents are going up and buildings are being cleared out in cases now along those nodes. And, in fact, the community is now organizing discussions and demanding special protections at transit nodes. But this is this is an unfair choice to say that either you improve your neighborhood and get driven out, or you don't want your neighborhood improved. That's an unacceptable choice.
Mayor Curtatone, speak about interventions in the market. I'll bet you do some already.
Yeah, we do. But first of all, Steve, it's great to have you on the same program that I get to be.
Likewise, Mayor.
And thank you for calling it a moral problem. You're absolutely right. You know, we can intervene in the market, but I agree with you, it's a moral problem. There are many technical things we fail to do, you know, as a region and as a commonwealth. You know, people shouldn't have to make a choice to fight for a transit node or stops like they did at Fairmont, or what we've been doing in some of our generations to right the wrongs of history, you know, to bring transit equity, to bring environmental justice to some of the most underserved communities, and then get displaced. But that's because as a commonwealth and a region, I think you'll agree, Steve, we have failed to align our mobility goals with housing goals, with workforce development goals, and economic development strategy. We've been provincial, we've been parochial, and we haven't, you know, Bill Cannellini actually alluded to this just in some of it, that we didn't plan for the future. Neither has a region. So what happens? We have displacement, and when we bring in growth, you know, the people we want to have participate in that economic growth don't get to enjoy that. They get displaced. We concentrate property more remotely, more intensely. So there is an opportunity to do a lot of important technical things that we can do right now. Yeah, we can intervene, and we have been doing that here in Somerville. We have stepped forth and empowered the community to plan our future, to plan it based on values. We set that out in Somervision, Chris, restated what we wanted, not just what we wanted to build, but who we wanted to be as a community, what our values were, who we wanted to participate in that economy, what kind of jobs we wanted to bring, how much housing we wanted. We did that in the Union Square neighborhood plan.
Speak of the range of interventions. I mean, it used to mean public housing. A lot of it got blown up. It could mean rent control, which has been voted down in Massachusetts, voted out in Cambridge. The end of rent control made Somerville rich because a lot of people had to get out to pay, not to pay the market rents. It could also mean more inclusive zoning. But speak of what Bill did, community land trusts. What's the promise
there?
I love it.
I actually, in my inauguration speech, and I've actually met with Alderman Scott, and I love that passion, and I'm all on board.
I live in a limited equity cooperative myself, and it's a great thing. It's kind of like a land trust.
There are two things right off the bat we can do, and there are many things. This is a very complex issue, but let's just speak of a couple of things we can do right now that have an impact. We need to build more housing. We can't be saying no to housing. We have parts. If you go one town over from Somerville, or a couple of towns over, there's less density than North Dallas. We are all part of this regional and this economy. We have a moral responsibility, but plus it makes economic sense to do this. So we need to build more housing. We need to have greater goals, and everybody needs to be at the table. I'm leading a coalition as the chair of the Metropolitan Mayor's Coalition, 14 cities in the inner core, to lead a housing task force in planning effort to put bold goals on production of housing. One, two, in Somerville we're showing.
I'm not hearing a change in the orthodoxy here.
No, but I'm saying, and so we need to gain control of the housing stock.
Well, jumping off from that point, Mayor, if you don't mind, I think it really is important to develop new affordable housing and to get housing out of the market like the land trust does. But if we are even at our wildest dreams of success in those goals, we're creating a tiny fraction of the housing that we need to house the people who are being driven out. And so the question of anti-displacement policy, the question of stopping people from being driven out of the homes that they're in, seems to be a question that's lacking in a lot of the policies, not just in Somerville, but throughout the metropolitan area, including Boston. And, we need to see something where, when that investor or speculator comes in and says, in East Boston, let's say, and says, my business plan is that I can buy this building and clear out the entire building and make a lot of money. Somebody needs to come in and stop that. And, we're trying to stop it at the grassroots level, but there needs to be some kind of policy that says, hey, this is just immoral. You can't do this.
No, I agree. And what we're proposing is that one of the things I put forth, and again, the things I'm talking about, they're not just my ideas. They've come from the community. They come from activists like yourself. They've come from others who've done it well. So whether it's putting a stronger condo conversion ordinance that actually protects tenants, and gets away from, does not allow speculators to circumvent the process to displace tenants as if their intent is to condo, or right to purchase program, which would help tenants who want to buy their units actually buy their units. Those are some important things we tend to intervene in the market right now and need to do, in addition to building the housing stock we need. I agree with you because, we're in a time now where this is the greatest demographic shift in our nation's history since mid-century. 54% of the world's population lives in city regions like ours, and by 2050, that'll be 75%. And so the demand to be in our community is high. One, there's not enough housing stock, and the rush for this housing stock that's available, it's almost impossible to compete for that. If you want to buy a two-family home, Chris, in Somerville, you better come with cash and at least probably $75,000 to $100,000 of asking, be ready to pay cash as is, and no risks, and all risks, and again, no inspection. That's what you're faced against. And who can compete with that, even if you're approved to a typical borrowing program?
Steve Meacham.
Well, you can develop a lot of home ownership opportunities on land trusts, so that instead of having the price of the housing go through the roof in that case, that example that Chris gave earlier, instead of having that happen, you can have it be gently increasing over the years at a 5% clip. And like DS&I in Boston has a lot of home ownership opportunities on a land trust, and we're trying to do the same thing in Dorchester. So that is a possibility. It still leaves out this question, though, of the thousands of people in Boston and in Somerville who live in apartments, and those apartments are getting bought by, I have to say, by speculators who are thinking that they can drastically increase rents or clear the buildings out. Hmm. Something's got to be done to stop that from happening. Otherwise, we just fall further and further behind all the time.
Mr. Mayor, I got to ask you, is it true that Jared Kushner, son-in-law of the president, cut his teeth in real estate flipping houses in Somerville when he was a student here.
That's what we've come to understand, you know. But let me just go back to the other piece of the interview. One of the other things we're going to be doing, we've already put it forth last week, was to create a transfer charge against speculation, against those who speculate the community. That could generate millions of dollars for affordable housing from that real estate speculation. So there are a bunch of things we're going to do, and we're going to be looking at your examples that you alluded to, Steve, on the land trust. Those are things we are going to be moving on. So we know
moving on them meaning what, Mr. Mayor? When you say moving on them, does the city create land trusts in your vision?
Well, we're going to work with it. I think the community-based land trust I submitted seems to be the better model to go. We're going to look at there's no idea there's a bad idea here. We are in a crisis. I'm facing this challenge. The transfer charge, we already put forth the home rule legislation language that's in the hands of the Board of Aldermen. We expect that to be moved on in the very near future. And we'll be coming in with an approach to understanding and creating the community-based land trust, learning from examples like Steve has just mentioned, as well as right-to-purchase programs and many others. We're looking, again, we don't need to do one thing. We need to do many things and do them right to have a real impact and a real intervention.
Stand by, Mr. Mayor. Steve Meacham, I want to reframe it a little bit. Is there an analogy here with health care, which was also described as a moral issue and a human right? I sense a certain, I don't know, there's a lack of imagination in the reform talk here.
Well, I would say in terms of health care, by the way, just to say to begin with, that the public pays a huge health cost bill in terms of the effects of displacement. It's a gigantic, what do the economists call it, an externality. You know, real estate does these investments mm-hmm. and all kinds of thousands of people get driven out. That's a huge health care bill. But to get to the other question you raised, you know, at moments that we've had healthcare reform on the table for discussion, it's ironic that despite the nature of the healthcare crisis, single payer hasn't even been on the table. And I'm not saying that to advocate for single payer right here in this conversation, but to say, why isn't it on the table? In this housing debate, the thing that's not on the table, frankly, is rent regulation and just cause eviction. It's the obvious solution that, at least in an interim way, stops the bleeding.
Take them separately. Rent regulation, meaning?
Some kind of regulation that says you can only increase rents so much per year. And in all the collective bargaining agreements that we negotiate with landlords, that's what we try to do. We win a lot of collective bargaining agreements with landlords where they limit rent increases to a certain fixed percentage per year.
You win them in court? You win them face-to-face?
We win them through bargaining, the same way a union does. You know, the same way a union wins higher wages than market wage.
Including when a building's just been sold?
Including when a building's just been sold. But, you know, to not have that on the table as part of the solution to this, the crisis is so grand that not to have that on the table is a big mistake.
Rent regulation was the first point. The second?
Just cause eviction. So an investor comes in, buys a building, and just gives everybody an eviction notice, a no-fault eviction notice.
Yeah.
Most of the people being evicted now that we see, 100 people come to our meetings every week, and they're all faced with no-fault eviction. I don't even think that should be legal.
Who gets evicted in Somerville, Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, we've seen the same thing. I was going to ask Steve. I assume you're seeing, like we are, that happens as a sort of go-around before they even declare a move on a condo conversion, sort of a backdoor way to get that. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, sometimes the lease to condo conversion, you're right. That's why the condo conversion laws are so hard to use, because the landlord doesn't stand up and say, yeah, I want to evict you because I'm going to convert to condos. They just say, you know, I want to raise your rent. And then later they say, oh, I decided to convert to condos, when that was their intention all along.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's the thing we're struggling with, and we're really pushing forward on working with the board and the community and how to protect, have stronger protections for tenants. Because right now, as you say, the current laws doesn't even come close, and they're getting around them so easily.
So who does or doesn't get evicted week to week, month to month in Somerville, Mr. Mayor?
Well, you know, we hear these stories constantly. I mean, they're heartbreaking. They're sad. You know, people get evicted constantly, and in this market, people are coming at a feverish pace, purchasing properties, as I just alluded to, at crazy prices, and they're just moving to evict people before they declare condo or whatever, and everyone's at risk here, young,
you're,
old,
you're
or
right.
Everyone's at risk.
It's awful. It's immoral. It should be illegal.
I agree.
How does it get fudged day to day in Boston, for example, Steve?
How does it get?
Well, not everybody who might be evicted gets evicted, and there's a lot of negotiation back and forth. What's the reality?
Well, I think the reality is that unless you reach a community advocacy organization like City Life, you pretty much get evicted. And I should say this, not
but
only...
But then how do you soften it?
Or, well,
or,
we,
or if, delay
if,
it? Or
when people get
it.
To our meetings, they not only learn their legal rights, but they also get social support in fighting their eviction. One of the things that is producing the mental health issues of displacement is the fact that people feel so alone. I mean, people come into our office and they tell their story and they're all breaking down crying. I mean, it's heart-rending. Every week it's like this. And, you know, people are talking about facing displacement, you know, by and it's just a heart-rending thing. So when people get to us, we can talk to them about how to fight it, both by using their legal rights. We call it the shield and the sword, legal defense and
Let's
public protest.
How do you do it?
Well, we combine a vigorous legal defense in terms of making sure that that a tenant is using all the procedural rights available to them. Combine that with public protest and pressure.
Does it work?
It does when people get to us, but you know, a tiny fraction of people are actually getting to us. So, one thing the city has done recently in Boston is to pass something that will inform tenants of their rights when they get an eviction notice. That's really important. That'd be a good thing for Somerville too, I think.
We're talking with the mayor of Somerville about that interesting, gritty, wonderful, various city on the other side of the Charles River, and a model, maybe, for the country. There's a foreshadowing in Somerville of what some job-hungry big city in America is going to have to face bargaining with Amazon. Coming up, this is Open Source. The romance of the modern, smart, and socially progressive city was born on the dot-com boom at the turn of the century. The theory of the case is a tale of two books, both of them written by the influential urbanist in Toronto, Richard Florida. 15 years ago, Richard Florida put out a book titled The Rise of the Creative Class and How It is Transforming Work, Leisure, and Everyday Life. But then last year, 2017, on a look at the latest evidence, he rewrote the story as The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class. This week I asked Richard Florida to put Somerville on his changing landscape.
Look, I didn't invent the creative class. I invented the name. I mean, the fact of the matter is Boston is a center for this. I mean, that's why companies like General Electric are moving there. That's why my wife, whether she's right or wrong, she's smarter than me, predicts that Amazon will likely locate in the Boston area with the HQ2. Over 40% of the workforce is in the creative class, ninth in the country out of 350-plus metros. But the thing that really got me thinking about this was there are other urban economists, not me, who've talked about trickle-down effects. And if you have high-tech growth and if you have knowledge economy growth, it all trickles down wonderfully and gloriously. And I said to myself, I don't think that's right. I think the creative class is doing fine, and these economies, according to metrics like innovation or startups, are doing fine. So we looked at the numbers, and the numbers are disturbing, daunting, and astounding.
Is it fair to say we're looking at the Amazon headquarters issue in advance here in a smaller form? A huge polarization around the best jobs in the world and a huge pressure on the bottom, what, 75-80%?
And that's why Amazon has decided to up and leave Seattle, because it did this to Seattle. You know, it's kind of gross neglect. Amazon here is the most highly valued company in the world with the richest man in the world. And, you know, I actually looked at the numbers. The Seattle Metro, on just a median housing price of purchase basis, is less affordable than the Boston Metro, the New York Metro, not Manhattan, New York Metro, or Washington, D.C. So we've already seen this happen. And yes, I mean, it's adding insult to injury. I mean, I would be all for, you know, Amazon coming to town, creating 50,000 jobs, working with the community to provide affordable housing. But look, putting 50,000 people in the Boston metropolitan housing market is going to drive up those housing costs even further. There's no doubt about it.
What's to be done?
We've got to hit the reset and say this urban revitalization, which many of us wished for, we hoped our cities would come back from the depths of despair. It has created a very privileged group of people. You know, our municipalities are going to have to buck up. And I think they're going to have to put pressure, you know, on these big tech companies that are raking in the money. Here's a company like Amazon that says, the hell with you, Seattle. We're going to up and leave and move somewhere else. And we're going to ask them to pay us money in the tax incentive. So I think it's time for cities to say no. But it's also time for these companies. You know, these companies are not beloved. the Amazons and the Googles and Facebooks are not beloved anymore. It's time for them to get the message and say, you know, if we want to be a good corporate citizen, we have to be a good urban citizen. And we have to help our communities by paying workers more, by investing in affordable housing, by investing in public goods like transit that make the city work.
Fascinating thing in the Somerville case, Richard, is that the new Board of Aldermen meeting this month for the first time has a supermajority for progressive reform. And, you know, land trusts not stop the investment, but pay first attention to the people here. I mean, what does that tell you? That politics does, in an old-fashioned, ethnic, working-class city like that, seem to respond, is responding to something.
You know, one of the daunting things that I discovered, and I think this is mayors and councilors, older people have picked up on this, our most progressive, our most innovative, our most left-leaning communities, and not just big communities like Boston or New York, small communities like Somerville or Boulder, Colorado, are also our most unequal. What that means is the pressures of the knowledge economy have been so great that what we've been able to try to counter them with, a little affordable housing here, a little inclusive zoning there, a minimum wage over there, have not been sufficient. So I see a big wake-up call. A big part of the urban revival and a big set of beneficiaries of the urban revival of places like Boston have been universities and medical centers, the so-called EDs and MEDs. They have been a propeller of that revival and a beneficiary alongside government investment and taxpayer investment in affordable housing. We need these anchor institutions like Harvard, like MIT, like Boston University, like Tufts to step up and say, you know what? We have also been part of the revival, but part of the problem. We pay our professors like gold, and in many cases, we provide them affordable housing. But our service workers, we pay terribly, and they don't have career advancement. We are benefiting from public investment and public transit, but not paying our share. I think it's time to engage these anchor institutions in a conversation about what it takes to make a great city. So I would start there and engage them. But I think there's a lot of other institutional actors in the greater Boston area that could help in this transformation.
That was the neo-urbanist Richard Florida. Mayor Curtatone, imagine, and I bet you've daydreamed this, imagine you're working out the terms of an agreement with Amazon for its second headquarters, and you're talking taxes. You're aware of the competitive race to the bottom between smart cities. You're worrying about the thumb on the scale for private investment. What's the deal? How does it come out?
Well, Amazon's not getting any tax breaks from Somerville. And our proposal, first, it's great to hear from Richard Florida, I'm a big fan, and he touched on some important points. But our proposal is unique in terms of Amazon in that it's a regional approach. It's designed to integrate jobs and opportunities into a string of really great greater Boston neighborhoods that will connect more residents to jobs and benefits it could bring. So rather than offering financial incentives to Amazon, we directly called on them to come here to be a good neighbor, invest in our community, benefit from our diverse and talented workforce, and join in the spirit of innovation to address our challenges, including housing. We're glad that they saw value in that. And the next step is to determine if they are a good fit for us and if we are a good fit for them. And our determination to shape our future according to our community values applies to Amazon as well and everyone else. But I'm also happy to hear Richard Florida call out academic institutions who need to step up and pay in for what they benefit from in terms of transit and infrastructure, but also the need to step up and help us address our housing challenges.
You think Tufts should pay taxes?
Yeah, I think Tufts should invest more. You know, I was proud to negotiate the first town down agreement with Tufts and the second one, but, you know, we recognize it's great to have such a well-regarded academic institution in our community, and I believe Tufts now realizes it's great to be part of a fantastic community like Somerville, but we need to understand that they have a big and important and moral responsibility, as Steve Meacham really that responsibility is, on helping us solve the housing challenge.
Steve Meacham, imagine you're bargaining with Jeff Bezos over Amazon and Somerville as a sort of mini model of the process. How does it go?
Well, several things. I think one thing is that you have some kind of community benefits agreement that insists that they house the workers that they're bringing in, that there's some kind of major construction of affordable housing that goes along with the development. A second thing is that we should be saying what their wages should be, because if we're going to invite Amazon in, Richard made the good point of what they're paying their workers. So we should be, there's a Boston Jobs Coalition that is demanding that new enterprises that come in not only not only pay their construction workers a living wage, but also pay their permanent employees a living wage. This should be done at Amazon, too. So both of those things should be a key part of any negotiations with Amazon. And, you know, really, we should not be in such a rush to seek investors like Amazon until we know what we're going to do with the people, until we know what we're going to, how we're going to solve the displacement crisis that that it will create.
There's another cosmic thinker on housing, Richard Sennett, the writer, author of The Fall of Public Man years ago. He grew up in public housing in Chicago. He lives now on the edge of the Dickensian Saffron Hill Diamond Market in London. He's lived in Shanghai, Berlin, and Boston, too. I asked him this week to reflect on the displacement danger in Somerville.
There's nothing natural about a place like Somerville suddenly flipping and expelling most of its longtime residents. There's nothing in the way people want to live or the way they make money that means that has to happen. It only happens when we say the market rules. It's a great drama all over the world. Now, you may think that I sound like Bernie Sanders, who's exactly my age, and you're right.
In a city like Somerville, what's the remedy? Politically, in terms of the conversation, shall we say the market orthodoxy that rules a lot of our lives, what is possible? Is this a solvable problem?
Well, I think it is a solvable problem. In Somerville, as I remember it, it's a community that's very vulnerable to being flipped and gentrified because the housing stock is very old. And it's difficult, this is a practical problem, to renew housing stock like that, get money for poor people to make loans to improve their own housing stock. It takes a deep pocket, and that deep pocket is often a developer. But the real issue with places that are menaced like that is restraint of the market. And that means the government has to be stronger. It has to be more assertive. It has to challenge economics rather than follow it.
Imagine a breakthrough American success in this housing crisis that's all over the place, the Bay Area, New York, metropolitan Boston, and Somerville. What might the breakthrough be?
Well, I think the first thing would be that you would build more public housing, which people wanted to live in. We don't want to repeat the mortgage crisis of trying to put people into buying housing, which, you know, they can't afford.
But you probably wouldn't want to go back to Cabrini-Green either, would you?
I would have. Actually, I was so sad when it was destroyed. When I lived in Cabrini Green, it was just poor. It wasn't filled with drug dealers. It wasn't filled with people who were kicked out of mental hospitals and just left on the street. It was a fairly self-controlled community. And although we were all very poor, I would say that our quality of life, given our resources, was pretty good. The notion that a poor community is necessarily dysfunctional is, to me, wrong. I'd start with raising up the bottom rather than trying to trickle down from the top. I have a lot of faith that that army of young people who supported Sanders and the army of young people here in the Labor Party are going to change that. But it's a struggle. It will be a struggle.
Richard Sennett was in London when we spoke with him. His new book is called Building and Dwelling, Ethics for the City. Steve Meacham of City Life, Vida Urbana. Speak to this point of market orthodoxy. Everybody was shocked that a presidential candidate could call himself a socialist and damn near win the Democratic nomination. Where would you challenge the housing fundamentals here?
Well, I think this is a great question. Market orthodoxy, what you might describe as market orthodoxy, is the center of the debate that has to be changed here. If you ask, what is the fair rent default position is not the market rent. There's nothing whatsoever about the market rent that's fair. If you ask a union, is the market wage fair, they're going to say no. They're going to say the fair wage is established through collective bargaining or through legislation like minimum wage laws or living wage laws. And the same thing is true in housing. If if you really want to address this, you have to start from the assumption that the fair wage has nothing to do with the market wage. And how does it get set? Through collective bargaining or through legislation?
And in housing, the result would be?
And in housing, you solve the displacement crisis because you prevent people from driving up the wage to, you know, keep assembling all this debt and driving up the rent to reach market levels. There's no reason for it. You know, the rents aren't going up in Boston because water and sewer costs are increasing. It's going up because of speculative increase in land value, because of more and more debt. That can be stopped.
Mayor Curtatone, would you just speak to the general point often overlooked that the United States government, as an investor in housing, is almost out of the game. And contrarily, young voters, especially in Somerville, seem to be very much into it.
No, I agree. I mean, the federal government is out of the game. The state of Omaha, they were out. Housing is not a priority to them. And, yeah, and young voters, you know, people are asking themselves, you know, people should be fighting and are fighting to have a stake in crafting and having a place in the economy, the future. And people want a real, authentic choice to be able to rent, buy a home, or start a business in the community they love. And for that most, that's a fleeting reality. And yeah, this is a battle for social progress. I agree that, you know, from inequality in wages, and we need a statewide living wage, from the ability to secure housing, the economy is not working for everyone. It, you know, and in this election, we saw people who spoke to those voters, spoke to those values, which are community values. That's who's representing them. And those are the majority of people who voted for Bernie Sanders. I think it's really important. You know, what Richard Tenet and what we've all been talking about speaks to the complexity of this issue, too. You talk about the market. The market's run away. We're in the second most gentrifying region outside the Bay Area. But in Massachusetts also, what compounds the problem, we have this system of, as you said before, these words, parochialism and provincialism that is driving us, is holding us back and exacerbates the inequality in our region.
Mr. Mayor, I can't get my mind off that huge 25-story tower that's going to change the whole feeling of that eastern end of Somerville.
Yeah,
walk us around those neighborhoods 10 years down the road.
Sure.
What's it going to feel like, and what's your vision here?
Well, the city is, our community's vision, as we planned out in our city's comprehensive plan, we've talked about the neighborhoods. Do we want to conserve the particular character of the neighborhoods? We talked about we've outlined where in the community around the future transit nodes of the Green Line that we want to enhance. And we talked about where the greatest amount of development should happen in the most densely populated city of only 4.1 square miles should occur in the transformative areas. In those areas, you know, we see community-based planning occur like in Union Square. The community has outlined the development of those areas.
Does the community really have the leverage here, Steve? I mean, are you persuaded of that?
Well, I think my comment on this would be to pick up on something that Richard Sennett just said, was that, you know, you really need housing that's outside the market. You need housing that's public housing or that's land trust, as the mayor was talking about. You need housing that's outside of the pressures of the market, that isn't bought and sold as a commodity. And so in Union Square or any place else where housing is being developed, as much as possible, you need it developed by nonprofits and by land trusts and things like that.
Yeah. Could it happen, Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, absolutely. We agree. We are in fully support of the land trust. We think that is a fascinating model, much like, you know, we've already proven with our 100 Homes program, we can gain control of housing stock and keep it permanently affordable. We need to take it out of that runaway, speculative market that nobody really can participate in.
Steve Meacham, last word.
Well, I would just say, you know, part of the problem in housing is created by the fact that we have this grossly unfair distribution of income and wealth. So to some degree, it's not the housing market's problem. It's the problem of general distribution of income and wealth. But as long as that's true, we have a gigantic problem to deal with within housing, and we have to challenge the market to solve it.
Thank you, Steve Meacham. Thank you, Mayor Joseph Curtatone of Somerville. Thanks also to our big thinkers, Richard Florida and Richard Sennett, and to our locals, J.T. Scott, Laurie Goldman, Mary White, Bill Cavallini, Ben Echevarria, and Ganesh from Nepal. Our show this week was produced by Good Neighbors All, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive mayor. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.